Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Iraq's future. The battle continues. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. There were massive truck bombs in Baghdad last week, even as Prime Minister al-Maliki claimed to have security well in hand. Will political instability lead to civil war? Will Iran extend its influence in Iraqi affairs? Should the U.S. continue its troop withdrawal? Also on Which Way LA, the L.A. School Board defied organized labor last night by opening up 250 schools to outside operators. We'll hear from the head of the teachers' union and the board member who sponsored the new policy. And we'll talk with an expert who says today's big fire should just be allowed to burn. First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Charter school operators say LA Unified has made history. The teachers' union says it might be violating the law. We'll hear a debate tonight. On Reporter's Notebook, a budget crisis for LA's most successful anti-gang program. Those stories at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. There's more political uncertainty in Iraq today with the death of Abdul Aziz Hakim, a powerful political figure who succumbed to cancer. In the aftermath of the U.S. invasion, Hakim gained enough influence to be a visitor at the Bush White House, but he also has close ties with Iran. Rod Nordland is in Baghdad for the New York Times. Rod, good to have you on our program. Just yesterday, there was a new political alliance announced in Iraq without Prime Minister al-Maliki in it. Put this current to death in context.
Well, the major component of that alliance, the UIA, is ISKI, the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, the party that Abdul Aziz al-Hakim headed. And they very much wanted to get the current Prime Minister, Maliki, on board and in that coalition for the next elections. The previous elections, you know, Maliki was part of the UIA coalition, which is basically a Shiite religious parties coalition. And he refused to join this time. And so that greatly weakened the alliance. It set up the prospect of an election that would split the Shia vote. Although there are a 60% majority, if the vote splitted, that would mean whoever had the most would have to make a coalition with either Kurds or Sunnis, and greatly complicating the political scene here.
So does the death then of Hakim strengthen Maliki?
Well, yes, I think it possibly strengthens Maliki. What it does, though, is throws the UIA coalition into disarray. And I think even though they had announced a coalition a couple of days ago without Maliki, I think they were still trying behind the scenes to persuade him to join, because it's clear he can't win without a Shiite coalition. It just doesn't have enough support from independents and Sunnis and other factions in Iraq. But he was insisting on terms, and his terms were if he joined the coalition, they would make him their choice for prime minister. And they refused to do that, mainly because of the opposition of ISKI and, you know, the party headed by Hakim. Now that Hakim's dead, it's a whole new ballgame, and ISKI is greatly weakened, and I think we'll see in the next weeks just how that plays out.
What about the bombings last week in Baghdad that were so devastating and damaging, presumably, to Maliki's claim that Iraqi forces could maintain security? To what extent have they weakened the prime minister?
I think they've hurt him a lot politically. He put a lot of stock in the idea that he could demilitarize the city, he could start taking down blast walls and fortifications, and make the city look more normal and feel more normal, because the level of violence has indeed gone dramatically down. A lot of people have been skeptical of that and saying he was going too far too fast, and indeed that's what happened. The foreign ministry and the finance ministries were both hit with huge loss of life and even greater wounded, more than 1,200 people wounded as well as 95 dead. And that would not have happened had those places not been defortified.
So what then, the election is in January, is that correct?
That's, well, as far as we know, they still don't have an election law, so it's not official. And that's one of the big problems they haven't resolved yet, is an election law that sets the terms and defines how the election will be carried out and so on. But everyone's talking about January for now.
Well, would it appear that if Maliki is weaker than had been thought, if he can't maintain security without American troops, will that get the Sunni insurgency fired up again? Will we see violence on that side? What about the Kurds?
I don't think the Sunni insurgency as we knew it in 2006-7 when there was the Second War, I don't think that's going to come back, at least not anytime soon. I think it will embolden, the terrorists and the few insurgents that still support the Baathists and for the most part Al Qaeda. I think it'll embolden them, and they'll do all they can to destabilize him. That's right. The Kurds is a completely different issue, but there's a big problem there because they have a lot of differences with the Iraqi central government and with Maliki over their borders and who controls parts of disputed territories that the Kurds want and the Iraqis want as well, mainly because they have a lot of oil on them. So that's a long-term problem, and I think both sides have agreed to put that on the back burner for the time being.
What about Iranian influence in Iraq at the moment? How has it changed as a result of recent developments?
Well, Abdulaziz al-Hakim died in Iran, and they're going to keep his body there for another day so that Iranians can pay homage to him. Then they'll bring it back here. I think one of the things that indicates is just how strong Iranian influence is. ISKI is a party that for most of its history was in exile in Iran, and Hakim, most of his life, lived in Iran as well. So their influence among the Shia runs very deep, and it's very strong. On the other hand, they tried extremely hard. They used a lot of political capital to try to force or persuade Maliki to join the UIA coalition, the Shiite coalition, and they failed to do that. And that's, an indication that there's a limit to their power. And there's also a lot of Iraqis, although even if they're Shia, they're also Arabs rather than Persians, and they're not necessarily completely trustful of Iran. So it's a very complicated picture.
Rod Nordlund, again, staff writer at The New York Times, talking to us from Baghdad. David Ignatius is associate editor and columnist at The Washington Post. He's the author of the spy novel The Increment. David Ignatius, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What do you think about the Iranian influence at this point? What's responsible for it? How has it contributed to political instability in Iraq?
Well, Rod is there, and he's seen with his own eyes and has given a good account. The only thing I think I would add is that the Iranians play the political game in Iraq with great subtlety. It's typical, I think, of the Iranians that they'll put down multiple bets at the same time. They'll support different Shia groups. They'll support Abdulaziz Hakim's ISKI, as Rod said. They'll support Muqtada al-Sadr's Sadrist movement. They'll support Prime Minister Maliki. I reported this week that there had been a kind of secret offer by the Iranians that if Maliki agreed to make certain changes in his government and was determined to run outside the Shia coalition, that the Iranians were prepared to deliver 49 parliamentary seats or to help him obtain 49 parliamentary seats. I think the Iranians like to bet on all the different horses in the race and then see which one is coming out ahead and adjust their strategy accordingly. They're determined that the future Iraq, a country with which they fought a bloody war, will not threaten their interests. And they seem to have, frankly, more staying power in this new Iraq than does the United States, as we've reduced our military presence in the cities, reduced our efforts to influence the political process. The Iranians keep going ahead full steam, and realistically, looking forward, absent changes in the situation, we have to expect that Iran is going to play a very strong hand in the future of Iraq, and that may pose strategic issues for the United States that we got to think about more.
Looking back to the conflict, why is it that Iraq poses a threat to Iranian interests?
Well, historically, under Saddam Hussein, Iraq was the Sunni Arab bulwark against Persian Shiism. The Iraq-Iran war was a kind of proxy war in which Saddam was fighting for all of his Sunni neighbors to contain the Islamic revolution in Iran, and there are centuries of enmity before that. That structure we knocked over, we kicked it over when we invaded Iraq in 2003. And inevitably, as we favored a democratic Iraq in a country with a Shiite majority, we ended up having an Iran-leaning Shia government running the country. I'm not sure U.S. strategists thought through very clearly what that would mean in terms of our interests, but that's where we are now.
Rod Nordland, back to you in Baghdad with the New York Times. Is there any chance that a government might be elected in January or whenever the elections are held that would not be dominated by the Shia?
Well, no, I don't. I think that at least there'll be a plurality of Shia legislators who are elected, but it'll all be in the coalition forming and the deal making that goes on after that, because it doesn't look like the Shia are likely to have an outright majority, so they'll have to make deals with either the Sunnis or the Kurds or independents or some mix of them. So that's all very much up in the air. Whatever happens, Iran is going to have a very big hand in what happens. And they, like, David's absolutely right. They're like very much on the wax, and they have the staying power here that the Americans don't have. I mean, people, a common thing you hear here is that the Iranians in Iraq behave more like another Iraqi political party than they do as a foreign power. I mean, they're that much kind of embedded into the whole fabric of the politics here.
David Ignatius says, I understand that there are Iranians in the Maliki government. Is that correct?
Well, I'm told by an Iraqi contact that if you visit Prime Minister Maliki's office in Baghdad, you can hear some people in his entourage speaking Farsi. I reported something that I was told by an Iraqi source that the plane that he uses for at least some of his official travel has an Iranian tail number and an Iranian crew. The Iranians are doing everything they can to help him, to support him, be his friend. The paradox about Iraq at this moment, and you could argue this has been the case for several years, is that the U.S. and Iran nominally support the same thing in Iraq. We both support the Shia-led government of Prime Minister Maliki. If it were possible for the U.S. and Iran to work together and come up with a stable formula for going forward in Iraq, that presumably would be in everyone's interest. That is much harder now after the political turmoil that followed the Iranian June 12 election and the fragmentation of the Iranian government than it was before. I mean, that's something the U.S. might have pursued aggressively as far back as 2006. But it is strange that at a time that we think of Iran as a rival, on one level, we sort of are backing the same guys in Iraq, specifically Prime Minister Maliki.
Juan Cole is professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Michigan. He blogs at the very widely read Informed Comment. His latest book is Engaging the Muslim World. Professor Cole, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What's your take on what we just heard, that there is this paradox that the U.S. and Iran have similar interests and yet serious rivalries made worse by what happened recently politically in Iran?
Well, it's all along, I think, been, since the fall of Saddam, a jealous girlfriend story. The United States wants the Iraqi Shiites for itself. The Iranians want them for themselves. The United States and Iran have a lot of similar interests in Iraq, all along have, but at the same time, the United States is attempting to blockade Iran, essentially. It has severe economic sanctions on Iran. It's attempting to prevent foreign oil companies like Shell and Total from investing in Iran. It strong arms India to stay away from Iran. So the United States is attempting to put the screws on Iran and to contain it. And the Iraqi Shiite government in Baghdad is not interested in containing Iran. So on that particular issue, the United States and the new Iraqi government are not on the same page.
I want to introduce another voice into this conversation, Peter Galbraith, who's former ambassador to Croatia, author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End, and Unintended Consequences, How the War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Mr. Ambassador, good to have you back on our program.
And very, very nice to be with you.
Pick up where we just left off. I presume that you're saying in that title that the war in Iraq strengthened America's enemies, including Iran.
Well, in my view, Iran was the big winner of the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. It's one of the big ironies is that George Bush justified the war in Iraq by arguing that there was a axis of evil between Baghdad and Tehran, when at the time he made that speech, there were no bigger enemies in the world than Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollahs in Tehran. And as a result of his actions, he installed in power in Baghdad the very parties that Iran had sponsored, had created and sponsored.
And they are now running the country. Would Maliki be included in that group?
Absolutely. And so that today there really is a Baghdad-Tehran axis, and there's no country in the world that's a closer ally of Iran than the government that the U.S. Brought in Iraq.
Back to Professor Juan Cole at the University of Michigan. Would you agree with that?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that you have to not just look at culture. Obviously, Arabs are proud and they don't want to be dominated by Persians and so forth. But the fact is that Iran has enormous resources that are useful to the Iraqi Shiites. The Iraqi Shiites themselves have kind of been under a Sunni blockade. Saudi Arabia won't let al-Maliki come to Riyadh. They have bad relations between Wahhabis and Shiites. The Sunnis in the north of Iraq have cut off a lot of trucking and things to the north. So Iran is a kind of escape valve for the Shiite south, and Iran provides electricity to much of Maysan province in the south. It provides its port access and trucking routes. It's giving Iraq foreign aid and to the tune of billions of dollars. It's offering refining facilities. So, you know, it's not just a matter of religious culture, but it is also the case that the Shiites of Iraq feel isolated. They look around the world around them, and they see enemies or they see hostile neighboring states. And Iran is friendly and is offering all these resources. So obviously they're going to take it up on them. I think whatever happens in the January elections, the Shiites will continue to dominate this government. And the new prime minister, whether al-Maliki continues or is has a successor, is going to fly off to Tehran and lay a wreath at the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini, just as all of his predecessors have.
Let's go back to Peter Galbraith. And, Mr. Ambassador, I want to move north to another issue that faces the Iraqi government and faces the Iranians as well, and that is the Kurds in Kurdistan, which extends into both of those countries. You at one point thought that Iraq ought to be divided into three countries, with the Sunni Shiites and Kurds in charge. Do you still feel that way?
Well, my point was that Iraq had divided, and indeed it has divided, between a de facto independent Kurdistan, which is recognized in the Iraqi constitution as having not only its own prime minister and parliament, but the right to have its own army. It keeps the Iraqi army out. It functions as in almost all regards as an independent state except for international recognition, and that frankly reflects the virtually unanimous view of the population there who do not want to be Iraqi. In fact, if you talk to an ordinary Kurd and call him an Iraqi, he finds that offensive. Now, as between the Sunnis and the Shiites, that's something different. Both of those groups think of themselves as Iraqi. It's simply that they have had a very different vision of what that means. And what I've argued is that the Iraqi constitution allows each of those groups the possibility of forming regions, running their own affairs, and that might be a solution that would bring about a more peaceful outcome. But that is really a choice each of those groups need to make.
I will say that the thing that turned the war around in 2007 and 2008 was the formation of the Sons of Iraq. That is this Sunni militia funded by the United States. And in effect, it was the creation of a Sunni army similar to what the Kurds have in the Kurdistan Peshmerga.
Well, what about the Kurds at this point? And if, in fact, there is instability, as we've heard there is, with the central government, how are the Kurds likely to respond? Is there an incipient civil war in the making?
Well, there's a danger of clashes along the border between Kurdistan and Arab Iraq because that border has not been defined. The Iraqi constitution contains an article that calls for a referendum in all these disputed territories. That referendum, which was supposed to have been held by the 31st of December 2007, has not been held, and so the Kurds say that's unjust, that the process should go forward. There's been resistance to that on the part of the Arabs. On the other hand, both sides have a lot to lose if fighting breaks out. Kurdistan has evolved into a prosperous place, and that could be put at peril. It would be very difficult for Iraq because the Kurdish forces are militarily very strong, and it would damage the international support for the Iraqi government. So I think there's also hope that the two sides will be able to negotiate to solve some of their differences and will be able to paper over or overlook some of the other differences.
Juan Cole, back to you. What about American action to try to keep things quiet in the north between the Kurds and the Arabs? What's being done in that regard?
Well, it's clear to me from things that have been said in the press that the Obama administration, high officials as well as military commanders, are petrified that the next big thing in Iraq is going to be an Arab-Kurdish civil war. And Joe Biden, when he went there this summer, apparently attempted to offer U.S. good offices in resolving some of these conflicts, which are of a territorial nature and could be negotiated rather than fought, reportedly in the press, at least, it was said that both the Kurds and the al-Maliki government rebuffed Biden and basically told him to butt out. General Ray Odierno recently floated a plan which I think would require Iraqi parliamentary approval to reinsert U.S. troops up north, both with Peshmerga forces and with Iraqi army forces, to try to tamp down the sectarian violence, the radical Sunni fundamentalists or the Baathists who have been obviously attacking Kurds and trying to get up this civil war. It's been one of the insurgents' tactics to foment civil disturbance as a way of undermining the new government. I don't personally expect Odierno's plan to go forward, just because I don't think the Iraqi parliament would approve of it. It is in violation of the status of forces agreement. But that Odierno put it forward seems to me an act of desperation. So I think that the Americans are afraid that this is a dispute that needs to be settled one way or another, diplomatically. Otherwise, it could go to violence and indeed civil violence, because in a province like Kirkuk, which the Kurds claim, but which has a very substantial Arab and Turkmen population, you could have rioting, massacres, and of course the another big danger is that substantial Arab Kurdish violence and Turkmen Kurdish violence could bring in Turkey, possibly other neighbors like Iran and Syria. So this is a geopolitical nightmare, and anything that the U.S. can do to forestall this scenario and I think it's a matter of getting some basic agreements between the sides hammered out before the U.S. loses its moxie by withdrawing its troops.
Ambassador Galbraith, what's your take on this geopolitical nightmare? Do you think that the United States ought to be sending troops to the northern part of Iraq? Does it have the troops to send?
Well, I think the United States ought to be playing a major diplomatic role in seeking to resolve this conflict. I don't agree that the Kurds rebuffed Vice President Biden. In fact, he never made it to the Kurdistan capital of Erbil because of the weather. And the Kurds are very dependent on the United States and very much influenced by what the United States wants. And that's why, in terms of diplomacy, the United States can play a constructive role. And I think it's very important that these territorial issues get resolved. They have been the source of conflict in Iraq since the founding of the Iraqi state. And if they aren't resolved, they could be a source of conflict for decades to come. And there is a provision in the Iraqi constitution to resolve it, a roadmap. Whether that's followed or some alternative is followed, the time, the opportunity exists to resolve it now, and that should be taken.
David Ignatius, back to you, associate editor, columnist of the Washington Post. Is there an argument being made within the Obama administration for American troops going to the Kurdish area to try to keep things quiet?
I think it's been discussed. I think there's very little enthusiasm for any major new commitment of troops. To me, the issue is, as U.S. troop presence is reduced, is the new Iraqi government that was created after the American invasion in 2003 going to survive? If Iraqis think that it basically is going to survive, I think that Iraqis will use political bargaining, occasionally perhaps with some fighting, some use of military force, to resolve these issues. If they think that state is coming apart, then I would expect to see a real battle to establish what are the dividing lines between Kurdistan and Iraq, in something that would look like a civil war. The hope is that with parliamentary elections scheduled for January and all of the political parties in Iraq somewhat weak, that there's an incentive for them to form coalitions. Maliki's weak now. The Shia parties, with the death of Abdulaziz Hakim, are weak now. The Kurds are pretty strong, but they've got a lot of problems, too, internally. So it's a situation where sensible people would figure out how to form coalitions, would make bargains, and you'd avert a disaster. Will that happen? Betting on good outcomes in Iraq is risky. But if I was going to describe what I hope it would look like as we head toward elections, that would be it.
Geopolitical nightmare may be the best phrase we've heard to describe what's going on in this part of the world. I want to thank all of you very much for being with us today. David Ignatius at the Washington Post, author most recently of the spy novel The Increment. Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Michigan. Informed Comment, his blog, the latest poll, Engaging the Muslim World. And Peter Galbraith, the former ambassador to Croatia, author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End and Unintended Consequences. How the War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Thanks to all of you and our earlier guest, Rod Nordland, with the New York Times, reporting from Baghdad. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, smoke from a big... That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, smoke from a big fire may be hurting your eyes. Should firefighters put it out or let it burn? On Which Way L.A.? Warm and only back with Which Way L.A. High temperatures, low humidity, and bone-dry vegetation have created conditions for explosive fire growth. That's the word from the National Weather Service. And sure enough, a 750-acre blaze in the mountains above Azusa is creating unhealthy air quality in much of Los Angeles County. Firefighters and water-dropping helicopters are on the scene, but one fire ecologist says instead of fighting it, they should be watching it burn. He is Professor Richard Minnick at UC Riverside. Always good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
That's advice that might not make sense to a lot of people if they haven't heard our conversations in the past. Why do you say that?
Well, in this case, whenever we have a fire, we should look at it as an opportunity of removing fuel that would otherwise threaten us in the future. And this fire is heading toward the north, away from Azusa, into the interior of the San Gabriel Mountains, and not far away are actually areas that had burned off in 2002 where there's very little fuel. So this fire is actually boxed in, and if it's a good opportunity to let it run as far as possible.
So you think it might then burn itself out?
It would burn itself out once it got into young fuel farther inland in the mountains.
What about the politics of this, and isn't it difficult for the firefighters to take that kind of advice, particularly when people all over the county are breathing noxious fire smoke?
Well, I see two questions there. One about the smoke is that, you know, we only have this a couple of days a year, when I think the more pressing question is the fact that we're generating industrial pollution on an everyday basis. Secondly, it depends on where you are. There are other parts of California where a relaxed attitude toward firefighting is now in place, and we've seen the results of it. For example, last year there was 1,000 lightning fires in central and northern California that were produced at once, and the fire agencies realized they couldn't put them out, all of them anyway, and so in a lot of fires in remote areas, they watched them. This year in Santa Barbara County, there was a pretty relaxed attitude toward the fire that burned the last several weeks in northern Santa Barbara County.
Now, are these decisions made because, in the first case, there are too many fires to put out, or is it a matter of policy?
Well, in that case, it was just too many fires to put out. But now we have more interesting constraints now, and that is a very bad economy. And it gets even to the issues about whether we can afford to constantly put enormous amounts of money into putting fires out that would otherwise get us in the future. Do we want a fire now in relatively nice weather where the fires are burning slowly uphill, or do you want it later in a Santa Ana wind in which the fire agencies really can't protect property and resources?
Has there been a policy of putting out fires automatically that has, in your opinion, left dangerous fuel, which is subsequently burned and caused yet more trouble?
Well, fire suppression has been in place for 100 years, and the result has been largely to make larger, more severe fires in the worst possible weather. The best evidence is just going into neighboring Baja California, Mexico, which has chaparral, but no fire management, and instead they have slow-moving fires that do not threaten property and resources.
What are you expecting this season?
This season, I don't expect anything unusual. Where the fires are most likely to happen is where the chaparral is the oldest, and we have maps of that. Find out where it's oldest. That's where your biggest threats are. So I can give you a couple of cases here. For example, the chaparral east of Mount Wilson and toward Monrovia Peak, it's about 80 years old, and here is an area of phenomenal fuel that's ready to go off. But in the eastern San Gabriel Mountains, most of it has burned off in the last decade, and in fact, there's very little fire threat in that area.
If, in fact, the chaparral east of Mount Wilson, the fuel there, were to catch fire, how dangerous would it be in terms of structures?
If it would be in a summer environment, the winds would be carrying the fire toward the interior away from town. If suppression continues, that fuel will probably burn in a Santa Ana wind and head toward Pasadena. I think it would be better to, if a fire does, even the current fire, if it happens to reach in that direction and get an old fuel. Here we are in the summer where there are no Santa Ana winds. This is an excellent opportunity to, again, get rid of a lot of fuel in a slow-moving fire in empty country.
What if the wind picks up and changes direction and starts blowing the fire toward buildings? If you adopt the kind of practices that you're suggesting, is it possible it could get out of control?
Of course it is, but now we're in that window of opportunity. The month of August is one where we don't have Santa Ana winds. It's not likely to happen this month. But by next month, especially after about September 20th, that becomes an issue.
Are they doing the wrong things now, do you think?
It's not just now. I think we've been doing the wrong policy for a long, long time. It's most of the 20th century. We're trying to fight an impossible process. The energy of fires is so much greater than the energy of suppression. Once a fire is large, it's like trying to stop a landslide halfway down. You know, the proper way to manage a landslide is to build walls in advance, or in the case of fire, to plan burn or watch burns to remove fuel. But you don't fight the fire or the process on the spot, because it will outgun you.
Should we then be engaged in lighting fires in order to get rid of the fuel?
Either that or be passive with fires that we don't plan, like the one that's ongoing. This current fire is a perfect opportunity to watch a burn go into the Williams Fire of 2002, and they will discover that, in fact, once it gets into that young fuel that's, what, now 7 years old, the fire will no longer carry. We can use the previous fire history as a basis of management of fires that occur now.
All right. We will see what happens in the next few days and in the more distant future. Richard Minnick, always good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you.
Earth Sciences Professor at the University of California, Riverside. I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. The chief of the California Charter Schools Association calls it a once-in-a-generation opportunity. The teachers' union calls it illegal. Last night, the L.A. Unified School Board agreed by a 6-1 vote to open up 250 schools to outside operators, 50 new schools and 200 that are failing under No Child Left Behind. Board Vice President Yoli Flores Aguilar wrote the proposal. Ms. Aguilar, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thank you.
How's this going to work? Who will make the decision that a given school will have outside operation?
Well, ultimately, it will be the Board of Education. It will come through the superintendent as his recommendation. And his recommendation will be based on a review of the plans that come forward, engagement of parents in the community about the various plans that were submitted, background on the folks that put forth the plan, whether it's a charter or a partnership group and whatnot. And at the end of the day, it will be a recommendation coming from the board, coming from the superintendent to the board.
And will it be a recommendation, do you think, that'll be controversial? Will the board have to argue about it, or will it be one of those things that the superintendent really makes the decision?
Well, that's very difficult to say at this point. I honestly don't know. My instinct is that given our very strong belief in our superintendent and trust of Mr. Cortinez, he's got an enormous amount of experience and background in education. He's a man of integrity. We work very well with him. My instinct is that it wouldn't be controversial because he will have done the best job to make sure that the plan that is proposed is the best plan for our students.
The LA Times says that one of the reasons for this is that it has been difficult to achieve more than incremental progress because of the teachers' union and the contract that makes it nearly impossible to fire ineffective tenured teachers. You said on our program on Monday that you felt that the teachers' union was insufficiently committed to a change and that business as usual is no longer possible. Is this a way to get around the union contract?
It is a way of really pushing the union and the district to change, to offer up better working bargaining contracts that give flexibility to our staff, to our teachers, that don't tie their hands to hundreds and hundreds of regulations. We have examples of that with the thin contract that has already been put in place with UTLA's support in some of our schools. I would encourage UTLA to put forth more of those types of thin contracts in our schools because we see the results that that is yielding.
Well, let's hear from UTLA. A.J. Duffy is president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, and as always, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Is this going to push you to make change?
Well, we've been pushing for change for 4 years. The pilot schools was a dead issue until we came to office 4 years ago, and it was UTLA that resurrected them and convinced then-Superintendent Romer that he didn't need to control every school and that this was a good thing. So I just need to go on record with that. We have the SBAM, Expanded School-Based Management Model School at Woodland Hills Academy, which is a charter without a charter. Last year, they raised their API scores 51%, and they have 70% minority kids. They have the full contract. This discussion of whether it's a thin contract or a thick contract, takes away from the real focus. And the real focus is there is a sense of urgency. Yoli and the board members are accurate in that, and we've been saying it for years. We have students who have been left behind for years, and we have to address that issue. We at UTLA have been trying to do it in our way. I think that this motion is, I think it's unfortunate, because I think we could have gotten to this spot a lot easier had the board and the bureaucracy on the 24th floor of LAUSD simply made sure that their mini-soups in the eight areas and directors got out of the way of reform.
Now, you have said in the past, though,
who have stood in the way of reform, not UTLA.
You have said in the past that if this resolution passed, you might well go to court. Do you intend to do that?
Well, we are looking at the legal option on several levels. We do not believe in the privatization of public education. We don't believe in the business model. And, I mean, look around. We've had the worst economic disaster since the Great Depression of 29, and that's the business model. What we believe in is a shared, distributed leadership approach to fixing schools, and that's what we're going to continue to push.
Ms. Aguilar, is this privatization?
No, and that's just the rhetoric that continues to come from UTLA and Duffy in particular. But charter schools are public schools. We all know that. It's a way, really, to try to drum up resistance to what we know is bold, innovative, out-of-the-box thinking, and that's what we're doing.
What about what's already been done, as listed by Mr. Duffy at Woodland Hills and other places? Doesn't that suggest that the union's on board?
Well, no, because we've been wanting to go to scale on that, and there's been no interest. I mean, Diffie and I have his recorded voicemail from when we started this dialogue about my proposal was that he acknowledged that they haven't done as much as they need to do, and if I would just make my proposal go away, they'd come to the table and start doing the reforms that they know are needed. So, you know, I don't believe that what they've done is enough. We've been asking for more. I have not seen the kind of collaborative partnering between the union and our district that is required for us to move forward on better education for our kids, and I hope that this encourages us to move in that direction.
Mr. Duffy, what would be the legal objections to this?
Well, first off, let me say that we have been pushing reform. We do have pilot models and other
parts
of the
city. Okay, we said
that
before. What would be the legal objection?
But Ms. Aguilar is not accurate. We want to go to scale as quickly as she does, and we've said over and over again, if you know of small learning communities anywhere in the city that want to go pilot, please call me, let me know, because we'll support that. As far as your other question, David Crippens and others in the Bond Oversight Committee have raised some concerns about giving the buildings away to charter schools when there is language very specific to charter schools in the bond measure. And I think you know, but the public needs to understand, that when you put a bond out there asking people to pay taxes to build something, in this case schools, you have to be very specific about the wording, and you can't change it after the fact. So, you know, we're looking at that, but at the same time, we have the same sense of urgency.
Okay.
I'm sorry that Ms. Flores Aguilar doesn't share that view, but
let me go back to her. What about this bond issue language question? Have you looked into that?
We did, and we had several meetings with the Bond Oversight Committee. Their lawyers looked at it after folks had expressed concern about that. They were satisfied that we were not violating any portion of the law or our commitment in the bond. Our general counsel and attorneys looked at it as well. So I am very, very confident that, because we were very careful about this, that there is nothing in the resolution that violates any part of our commitment in the bond or to any law.
The Charter Schools Association spoke, as I indicated at the outset, about this in sort of historic terms. As regards the 50 new schools, what about the 200 failing schools? Do you really think that there are going to be applications for a new operation of those schools? Don't they pose challenges that nobody may be able to fix?
That's exactly right. I do not see that there is sufficient capacity in the charter world to take a significant number of these poorly performing schools that are what we call PI 3+, program improvement 3+ status. There might be some that might take one or two. It is very, very difficult to transform, to shut down and transform, if that's what it requires, any school. So I don't see droves of charters lining up for that. That's going to really require us as a district to step it up and improve those schools in large part ourselves. But if there are operators out there that think they have a better plan, let them propose it and then let the community weigh in and let the superintendent make the recommendation to the board.
If there aren't any applications for those schools, can the board do anything that it couldn't do before as a result of the resolution that passed last night?
It can still shut down schools. We are authorized by No Child Left Behind to shut down schools that have been in PI 5 status. So there's nothing stopping us. We just haven't done it. We have not played a leadership role in doing what we need to do to make our schools better for kids. And again, the impetus, I hope, of my resolution is that that will encourage us and force us to move in that direction.
Even if the operation didn't change, is it possible that you could still close a school, then reopen it as a new school without the union contract, with what you refer to as the thin contract?
It is possible. I think that there's language in No Child Left Behind that we have to look at to see what exactly other places have done that. Chicago, I know, has closed, shut down schools, Washington, D.C. So it's absolutely possible, and it's absolutely possible that we would still need to negotiate. And I do recall that there is language that we would need to negotiate with our bargaining units.
All right. So a big change is in store at the L.A. Unified School District, but much continues to be available to argue about, and we will follow that all in the future. Rayoli Flores-Aguilar, many thanks to you. Again, Vice President of the District Board, and A.J. Duffy, the President of the UTLA. Thanks to both.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Homeboy Industries has won international acclaim by offering jobs and counseling and schooling to rehabilitate gang members for the past 21 years. Roman Catholic Father Greg Boyle has faced gunfire to stop gun violence and get sworn enemies to work together. But now he says he's been losing sleep for another reason, money. Father Greg, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thank you, Warren. Good to be with you.
What do you need? How much have you got?
Well, you know, we sort of had the convergence of two things, the economy kind of going south and then us moving to this from 22 square feet to 21,000 square feet. So and we're just packed, you know, and we draw from the whole county. So there's no place in the United States of America that serves more gang members wanting to redirect their lives. So we're just huge. We just got approved for a small amount of money from the city. Nothing from the county, and the state owes us money. And foundations are kind of evaporating a little bit because of the economy. So we're living from payroll to payroll, and we don't want to stop our comprehensive services because they're pretty unique in this county.
The state owes you money? Didn't you get scrip?
We didn't even get an IOU. Yeah. We finished a contract for them with the Youth Authority where we went in and then prepared them for release and then caught them when they were released. And we haven't been paid yet. So all those things combined together, and it's sort of a cash flow white-knuckle ride.
What is the budget, and how much are you short?
Well, we're a $9.5 million annual budget, and about $3 million of that comes in through revenue through our five businesses. And with each quarter, we improve that prospect with more revenue. But that's a $6 million shortfall that comes through fundraising and our own shaking of trees, and we have this virtual car wash. We're trying to get a million people to give $10 each, so if they go to our website, we can hopefully create some kind of viral movement towards democratizing our fundraising. So we're doing everything we can, but it's expensive to run this, but I think it's costlier to imagine us not being around.
Just to give our listeners who might not have heard of Homeboy Industries before a sense of what we're talking about, again, you've been going for 21 years, and you have received grants year after year after year from major corporations, government, and all kinds of different agencies, the California Foundation, California Endowment, and organizations of that kind.
That's correct, but 40% of our, you know, comes from foundations, and this has been a particularly difficult time. We're not the only nonprofit to be, and many have shut down because of this moment in time. And, you know, we've been struggling probably for a year, and we've been able to meet payroll each time, but it's just barely so. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, we've been doing this now for over two decades, and one of the reasons we're so unique is this population comes here with a level of comfort, and you can set up all sorts of things all over the city and the county, but if this population won't go to you, it matters very little. So we're pretty unique, and we think that it's worthy of sustaining and keeping alive and thriving.
Given your success, so why do you think it is that others haven't emulated what you do?
I wouldn't say that they haven't. I mean, in fact, we have all these relationships with cities across the country. We've refused to franchise because we sort of don't want to become the McDonald's of gang intervention programs. So we want people to have their own cast and their own shape, and we want them to give birth to something from below, as this was. But they come here. Many cities from all across the country come here, and we go there so that we help them and give them technical advice. So I would say we're a national, international model in as much as people come here and we go there to kind of help them set up programs similar to this.
Mayor Villaraigosa has been touting what he calls the Summer Night Lights program, keeping parks open at night. Do you see any impact of that, a very different kind of thing from what you do, obviously?
You know, obviously it's a good thing, and all things help. You know, this city has, the people in this city have been doing comprehensive gang outreach for, you know, nearly 20 years, and they've done it by way of after-school programs, mentoring, Homeboy Industries, Toberman, communities and schools, lots of places. So I think the city ought to just put their arms around all these places that have been doing this work for two decades and help, because rather than reinvent the wheel, a lot of us have had four tires on the ground and the tires are bald. So, you know, we'd certainly like some assistance, not just myself, but all the places that are addressing every aspect of this thing, not for a short amount of time, but for the long haul.
If people want to contribute to Homeboy Industries, how can they do it?
They can go to our website, which would be the easiest way, at www.homeboy-industries.org.
Again, to once more?
www.homeboy-industries.org.
Okay, we'll put that on our website and have a link to it as well. Father Greg Boyle, as always, good to have you on our program.
Always great, Warren. Thank you very much.
Again, Executive Director of Homeboy Industries, job placement, training, education for gang members who want to turn their lives around. Which Way LA, produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Gary Scott, and Christian Bordahl. Our managing producers, Cameron Radziner, Technical Director, Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9. KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.